This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A little more than a month has passed since the state's soft reopening to tourism, and while daily arrivals are back in the thousands, the industry is far from rebounding. Concrete data on visitor arrivals, specifically where they're coming from, hasn't been released, but with COVID hotspots breaking out across the country, there's a renewed worry that even with the pre-test program, tourists may be bringing the virus with them, compounding the local community spread. With a month of lessons behind us, The Conversation's Harrison Patino spoke to economist Summer LaCroix of the University of Hawaii's Economic Research Organization.
In some ways, it's been relatively successful. People have come to Hawaii with negative tests, and they haven't had to face a 14-day quarantine, and they've been enjoying themselves in Hawaii. But the reopening hasn't come without some problems. One of the problems has been that people arrived in Hawaii with tests that were not approved under our trusted testing partner designation, and those people faced a 14-day quarantine. That was unfortunate. We also found that there are some people who took their test, didn't have the results when they came with them, and then they found that the results didn't easily get to the authorities in Hawaii, and those people have also faced quarantines. So in some sense, that's been unfortunate. It's probably not that unexpected. Difficult to do something like open up tourism with testing and to do it smoothly. The critical point for the state is to make sure that these problems don't persist. When we look ahead toward the Christmas season, that these problems are not there. Solving the problems really requires that we do more education of tourists when they purchase their air tickets, that they receive information about exactly what testing partners are required. And the state needs to figure out better how to handle people who come here who have tests that are not from approved testing partners.
Now, as the holiday season looms upon us, we're seeing nothing but increased rates of transmission in communities, especially from small family gatherings. But the general consensus right now is that COVID is spiking in a big way across the country. Do you think that's going to have a tangible effect on people's willingness to travel to Hawaii?
It's very hard to say. It could well be that people want to get away from the epidemic that's there at home. And if they perceive Hawaii to be a relatively safe travel destination, we may find there's lots of people who decide to travel to Hawaii. On the other hand, in that period leading up to the holidays, usually people are running around trying to get things together. They're trying to purchase gifts. They're trying to make arrangements for the holidays. And this year, all that stuff becomes harder. It may well be, too, that they wanted to travel and be with a larger group, and that traveling with a larger group doesn't make a lot of sense right now. People may still be worried, too, about what type of situation they would face in Hawaii, whether or not they'd essentially be able to have the Hawaii vacation that they want to have. All that stuff is still very uncertain. It's useful to remember that we opened up with a reasonable number of people coming back from the U.S. mainland. We've been having between 6,000 and 8,000 visitors come per day. That's quite a few. Normally around this time, we would get about 30,000 visitors, but some of those visitors would typically be from Japan. So if we're looking at domestic visitors, we're still getting back a reasonably large share of the domestic market.
Now, you mentioned there this idea of people trying to get away from the pandemic in terms of having a Hawaii vacation. Precise data documenting where exactly incoming tourists are coming from isn't really readily available, but we can look at historical trends to give us more of a localized idea of daily arrivals. Is there any historical evidence to suggest that we may be seeing a large number of visitors coming from COVID hotspots?
Well, most of the country seems to be a COVID hotspot right now. Clearly, traditionally, we've had large numbers of people come to Hawaii from the U.S. West Coast, from Washington, Oregon, and California. We've also had a large number of tourists come from the Mountain West region. And most of that region is right now a COVID hotspot. We actually don't know where the visitors are coming from. The state does, because the state essentially is taking addresses of everybody who arrives in Hawaii. So they know where the visitors are coming from. In many ways, I just don't think it makes a lot of difference, because the whole country is essentially a big COVID hotspot.
Now, more recently, just this week, Governor Ige issued a statewide mask mandate. You've advocated for low-cost penalties for not wearing a mask. Do you see this mandate as a major step in the right direction? Of course, this is coming from your perspective, not as a public health professional, but as an economist.
It is moving things in the right direction. It's clear that people should be wearing a mask much more often. I think that the mandate doesn't go far enough. It should just be saying that when you're out in public, you should be wearing a mask. That's a clearer mandate. It would be easier to enforce that mandate with visitors. The current mandate still has all sorts of exceptions, and the 6-foot exception away from each other just makes the mandate difficult to enforce. As far as the penalties for not wearing a mask, the current penalty, a $5,000 fine or up to 1 year in jail, is just far too high. It's far too serious of a penalty for what is a relatively simple violation of the law. What would be better would be to set a penalty that was more like a parking ticket. And I would just throw out the $100 idea that having a $100 penalty for not wearing a mask with limited rights of appeal from that decision would, I think, give people all sorts of incentives to wear masks. Nobody wants to be cited for a $100 fine that they're pretty sure that they're going to have to pay. Whereas under the current system, people essentially are going to fight tooth and nail not being convicted of a misdemeanor. It's a system that just doesn't make a lot of sense right now. I hope that the Hawaii legislature, whenever it comes into session, that it passes new penalties for not wearing a mask. I think it's a good start. It's a good start because we need to be moving toward a mandate that says when you're in public, you wear a mask. I think there's still too many exceptions in the governor's order. I really don't see the problem with when you're outside and you're walking that you're wearing a mask. I don't think we need to be parsing whether or not you're going to be coming within 6 feet of people. If you're outdoors, you're in public, you should be wearing a mask. The good thing about that type of strong mandate is that it makes it easy to enforce. It's easy to tell visitors who come to Hawaii that if you're in public, you need to wear a mask. Right now, the mandate is somewhat parsed. Would a visitor say, oh, I'm walking down the street in Waikiki, I'll try to stay 6 feet away from people so I don't have to wear a mask? I think the problem is that this makes it more difficult for the police to enforce such a mandate.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, daily arrivals to the islands are in the thousands, but by no means has that number even remotely rebounded to what those numbers were a year ago. Now, predicting the direction this pandemic is going to move in has proven difficult in every regard, but given how the state has adjusted to tourism so far since the soft reopening about a month ago, how do you see things proceeding for tourism in Hawaii in the near future, in the next couple of weeks, months, maybe even the next half of a year?
It's very difficult to predict. I think a lot depends upon what happens to the epidemic on the mainland. A lot depends upon what happens to the epidemic in Hawaii. And our epidemic in Hawaii has mostly been community transmission. It hasn't been transmission where predominantly it's returning residents or tourists bringing the epidemic to Hawaii. It's been transmission among local residents. If we don't have our own epidemic under control, it's hard for us to host a good tourism experience. If there's a raging epidemic on the mainland, it's just unclear exactly how people will respond to that, whether or not they want to take vacations. They may decide not to take vacations because they're worried about losing income. They may decide to take a vacation just because they feel like they've been cooped up for much of the winter and that it's time to go somewhere that looks relatively safe. It's just really hard to predict that.
And now looking towards international travel here, let's look at one of Hawaii's largest international travel markets, which would be the Japanese market. I mean, how crucial is that market going to be going forward?
Well, I don't think we're going to see many Japanese tourists in Hawaii for a while. And the basic reason why is Japanese tourists who come here face a 14-day quarantine upon return to Japan. It's very difficult to take a vacation and then face a 14-day quarantine when you return home. So I expect we're going to see relatively few Japanese tourists coming here. What might cause the Japanese government to remove the quarantine? It would be that Hawaii gets its own epidemic under control. Is it possible that that will happen over the next few months? It's possible. The prediction, though, is that we're probably going to go a bit in the opposite direction. If you look at national models, such as the University of Washington International Health and Metrics Evaluation Group, that model shows cases tripling in Hawaii over the next few months. Of course, whether cases triple or not is partly under our own control, whether or not we take proper measures to prevent transmission. But I expect to see very few Japanese tourists here. There is an agreement in place that allows Japanese tourists to come to Hawaii if they take a RT-PCR test prior to travel and they have a negative result. The good thing about that agreement is, again, the Japanese tourists who come here are likely very safe. DeWolf Miller, Tim Brown, and I estimated that only 1 in 50,000 Japanese tourists would be COVID positive when they came to Hawaii, which is a very small number. Japanese tourists have more to fear from interacting with locals than locals have to fear from interacting with Japanese tourists. I think there's two factors operating here. One is that we're never going to see a full recovery in Hawaii until we can get the tourism industry up and running. That doesn't mean that we get the full 10.4 million tourists that came in 2019. But until we're up to half to two-thirds of that total, the Hawaii economy is going to be characterized by high rates of unemployment. And we're going to find that there's all sorts of people here who are going to be suffering. Now, in the early part of the epidemic, the CARES Act relief money helped people enormously. Even though people lost their jobs, they received the $1,000 payments, they received the extra $600 per week in unemployment pay. There was special unemployment assistance for people working in the gig economy. There was all sorts of relief that was provided. Now, much of that relief ran out in August and September. And so Congress's failure to pass a second CARES Act has really been negative for Hawaii because we have one of the highest unemployment rates in the country. We're one of the three or four states that's really suffering from the epidemic. And if Congress does not pass another relief package sometime soon, I think we're going to see an awful lot of problems with families struggling in the state trying to feed themselves, pay their rent, pay their utility bills.
Senator, any final thoughts on what we've touched on today?
I think the main thing is that the state needs to continue to work on the whole business of opening tourism. It's something where every single person involved in tourism and every person living here in the state has a big stake in. If we don't get tourism reopened, the state economy is just going to have tremendous problems over 2021. But it's something that people in the tourism sector need to ask, what can they do to help make Hawaii a safer place and pick up the responsibility a little bit more. But we find this all over the place. I think local residents, too, really need to ask themselves, what will happen if my neighbors who live next door and are employed in the tourism economy don't have employment over the next 6 months? It may well be that many of us enjoy walking around Waikiki with fewer people and with nicer beaches and cleaner oceans. But if tourism does not reopen sometime soon, what we're likely to see is just enormous suffering by a large portion of Hawaii's population. I think what's neat, really, is sustained effort by all the stakeholders in tourism. You know, and the stakeholders are the public, there's tourism workers, there's all the people who are not working in tourism. What we need is sustained involvement from everybody. It's hard to keep up sustained involvement in an effort, but this is one that if we do it, there's going to be large gains to Hawaii. With something like the CARES Act, okay, whether or not Hawaii is going to get a second round of relief, at some point we are, but part of the question is when. Is it possible that Congress and the president will reach an agreement before the end of November? You know, it's possible. There's a lot of people out there suffering, and it's very possible the two sides will reach some type of agreement. And an agreement would really benefit Hawaii just because we have so many unemployed people and people who are suffering from the epidemic compared to other states. It could well happen in December when Congress reconvenes again, or it might be until after Biden is inaugurated as president on January 21st, and Congress might then still not pass a relief package until negotiations are over with sometime in February, and relief might not appear until March. That would be close to disaster for Hawaii if that happened.
That was UHERO economist Summer LaCroix talking with The Conversation's producer Harrison Patino. They were talking about lessons learned from the pandemic as Hawaii continues its efforts to rebuild its shuttered tourism sector.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, welcoming the community to reconnect with the art and museum spaces on Pauhana Friday evenings until 9 p.m. More at honolulumuseum.org.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Jordan Gruber, co-author with Dr. Jim Fadiman of Your Symphony of Selves, and next time on New Dimensions, we'll be talking about the reality of the many selves inside us.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Up next, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're going to test you on Hawaii's natural wonders. There is a natural tide pool on Kauai's North Shore located near the town of Princeville, known as Queen's Bath. The pool is essentially a sinkhole surrounded by solidified magma rock walls. And although it's described as a spectacular location, visitors are advised to steer clear. Injuries and deaths have occurred over the years. However, there are some who feel the area is safe to swim when the surf is small and the pool is calm overall. Even when the surf is flat, waves do crash into the rock walls and shoot ocean spray high into the air from time to time. This poses a threat to anyone standing near Queen's Bath, as the power of the waves can easily sweep people into the ocean and carry them out to sea. For today's quiz, can you tell us where another Queen's Bath existed in Hawaii? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Thank you.
Ben Trevino was recently named the president and CEO of the Hawaii Institute of Public Affairs, also known as HIPAA. The organization is one of Hawaii's first public policy think tanks. It's published several reports on the state of Hawaii's infrastructure, fisheries, and venture capital. Trevino spoke with The Conversation's Jason Ubai about his journey to this point and his vision for the organization.
In my career, I think I've kind of split time between being working in technology and software and innovation and working in the public sector and in nonprofits and in mission-driven organizations. And I think I've just been really interested in what all the organizations that are doing work to kind of improve the quality of people's experience, improve the quality of people's lives, and to really directly help families. You know, I think at the end of the day, when we interact with each other and when we look at the big picture, there's all these things going on in terms of policy and budget and vision, but it's all supposed to boil down to ensuring that families have what they need to be able to succeed and thrive. And so I think as I've gone through my career, I've always looked for ways that I can contribute to that. And in some cases, it's been, you know, when I was at UHERO, it was about communicating the research that UHERO was doing on the economy and making that accessible to people so that they can use it in their own decision-making. And when I was at BikeShare, and so I was the president and chief operating officer of BikeShare Hawaii, and we launched the Biki BikeShare system, that was really about giving people an alternative to being able to get around, both one that was affordable and one that was healthy and convenient and something that residents and families could have in their mobility tool set. And that really got me, I think, working on BikeShare and kind of getting to understand the relationship between moving around the city, being able to access jobs and opportunity, really got me interested in equity and transportation. And that was what drove my work at HART on the rail. And really looking at what public transportation facilities do we have that offer families and residents a chance to be able to have a lifestyle where they can access what they need to access and really primarily work, you know, live in a place that's affordable and then access work and do it at a scale that can really have an impact on the island. And rail was that answer. It is such a transformative system. And I know rail has had its struggles as a project, very difficult project, but in terms of the kind of transportation that is sustainable, it's electric, and it's high capacity. It can really move a lot of people. Was for me part of the question of equity in transportation. And so I've tried to follow these different projects and these different ways that we as a community, as Hawaii and as Oahu and as Honolulu, are really trying to move forward to help that experience for individual families. And HIPAA was kind of the next step in that for me, especially when COVID came and we started to feel the impacts of COVID on especially our visitor industry. It was pretty clear that there was going to be a significant economic effect and that people were immediately going to feel it in terms of their ability to work, their income, and how it affected their day-to-day lives. You know, I think we all realized that what we were doing before isn't going to work both now in this COVID time specifically, but also moving forward. You know, we look at what is coming down the pike. You know, is something like COVID an aberration, or is it something like what we'll be experiencing? And I think with all of the different kinds of dynamics in the world, all different kinds of forces, it seems that change and the pace of change is more likely than things being consistent and steady. And so it's really important for us to be able to be resilient to those changes. And be prepared for them. And I was just really interested in working on that. You know, having worked with a lot of communities, hearing all of the good work that Malama Aina organizations are doing, for example, to understand how people relate to place and how we can work in partnership with our environment and our ecosystems. Those kinds of things, I think, are really valuable for our conversation about resiliency, and having those things kind of bubble down so that the so that families can engage them, but then also bubble up to the policy level. I was really interested in making those connections.
HEPA is known for research. What kind of research do you see HEPA engaging in the near future?
So I think right off the bat, the most pressing issue right now is really about the economic impact of COVID. And there's a lot of great work that's already happening on that front and how we adapt as an economy. And I think there's a part of the adaptation that is, what do we do to stabilize and help families right now? And I think that's all hands on deck. We all need to be doing something on that. We want to do that, and we want to be doing that with an eye towards the future, towards the kind of economy and the kind of structures that we have to have in place so that we can be resilient. And so the research that we're going to focus on, I think in all aspects, will have some element of that, whether it's directly commenting and researching different economic situations in Hawaii or in things that have a clear influence on the economy, like schools and the Schools Facilities Administration and 21st Century Schools. Those kinds of efforts are where we want to start focusing our research, at least to start, and then see what other resilience pathways open up from there.
Certainly nationwide, the population is very polarized, and we're seeing this dispute of facts and not just ideology or opinion. How can HEPA's research and HEPA itself, how can it break through these narratives and inform our policymakers about, using actual facts and trying to get emotion out of the way?
Yeah, that's such a good question. It's such a moment for the legitimacy of information right now. How does one become informed about what's going on? How does one create trusted information? I think from my perspective, and I think this has been HEPA's perspective throughout its lifetime as an organization, it's really been about listening. Can we as a convener, can we as a research organization and as a policy-focused organization listen to all sides of an issue and hear what people are saying and really try to dig into the details? And I think, as people challenge information, challenge facts, I think part of what they're saying is that they haven't been heard in the past. I don't think it's necessarily a desire to exclude science or a desire to exclude the perspective of, non-science points of view. I think it's a desire to understand the different forms of information as being valid and part of the conversation. So what I hope that we're able to do and contribute to this front is to look at the way that we do research and look at the way that we examine policy and that we bring people's voices into our work in a way that honors their experience and honors their experience as community members, as people who have families and who have been, honors their lived experience. And I think that I suspect that we'll go a long way in creating a trusted source of information. If people are able to see that what they have said has been listened to, I think it opens up the pathway to being able to connect with other people's experiences and how that factors into information.
I think historically HEPA has been a fairly lean organization. Do you see, more staff members to try to reach out to these communities and fill some of these research and objectives you have?
Yeah, I think we, as an organization, we will staff as we need to, I think, based on projects. But what I'm probably most interested in is the relationships that we have with other organizations. I think if we think about what the content of research is, it is a lot of what we need to do in terms of listening and documenting is already being done by many organizations here in Hawaii and certainly in other, around the world. But I think what we need to do a better job of and what we need to have capacity for is to be able to connect with those organizations. And when we do that, if we have strong connections with the organizations that are on the ground, that are working with people day to day, then we'll have a tremendous capacity to do public engagement in general, because there is so much capacity that's already in our community to do that. We don't necessarily need to be huge, as HEPA and as a HEPA staff to be successful at that. I think what we need to do is dig into those relationships and make sure that we have strong connections to all of the people who are relating to the public in different ways and through their different organizational lenses, and continue to maintain and invest in those relationships.
That was Ben Trevino, president and CEO of HEPA. Along with research, the organization is also known for printing a directory of Hawaii's public officials. No word yet on if that tradition will continue, but Trevino says he'd like to. You can stay up to date with the organization's latest reports by going to HEPA.org. We'll also have links on our website. Our reality check this morning turns our attention to Oahu's rail project. Surprise, surprise, its price tag is rising. A HART Finance Committee takes up a new budget at its meeting tomorrow. Honolulu Civil Beat's Marcel Honore covers transportation issues and joins us today. Good morning.
Hey, morning, Catherine. Deja vu on rail
yes.
all over again.
So, oh gosh, so tell us about this meeting tomorrow.
Well, yeah, I mean, just to back up a little bit, you know, we've been, the signs have been there for a few months now that there's been a reckoning on the horizon, another reckoning on the horizon for rail, and that's really kind of coming to a head now. The most recent the price estimates that we're seeing are now $2 billion more than what they had budgeted for, and that's on top of a rough estimate of at least $400 to $450 million hole in terms of their revenues during the pandemic. So this project is now facing yet another massive budget shortfall. The HART board will be meeting tomorrow again. They've been having a lot of meetings just with all of the crises that are sprouting up with this project. And we expect them to have a briefing from the embattled executive director, and his future with this project remains unclear. But a lot should be happening even today as we speak as to whether the city will finally officially shut down this public-private partnership effort that's been going on for more than 2 years and which HART has still strenuously been pushing for as the best option, given everything that's happening. They are really going to the mat for P3, but the city is really pushing back. And we should have an idea. If the city officially shuts it down, we could see basically kind of HART finally surrender to that at tomorrow's meeting.
So, your headline of your story says that the rail opening is pushed to 2033 and that this price tag, may hit like $11 billion. So, all these issues then are going to be taken up at tomorrow's meetings?
Yeah, that'll probably come up. Now, the thing about that 2033 estimate is that it's coming entirely from the city. Amid this whole rift over whether or not to pursue a P3 or not, the city and HART have really been going on two separate tracks right now. They're aware that they need to get back on the same track, especially in the eyes of the FTA and that funding. But this 2033 date, which is a very jarring and eye-opening date, that is something that the city is putting out there separate from HART. HART, in its own report this week to the city, is saying, we think, based on all the problems we're facing, it'd be like late 2027 to early 2028. Now, the tricky thing here is HART has obviously all the expertise on the project, but HART throughout its history, as anybody who's been following, that they've never really hit their schedule marks and they've never really hit their budget marks. So while it's not entirely clear how the city is coming up with this date, one thing that is for certain is that they are trying to manage expectations, right? They are trying to for the public to finally kind of maybe underpromise and overdeliver. But the scary thing is, to do that, they have to put out this really crazy date, which could wind up being true, which is 2033 for the final completion all the way to Ala Moana Center.
Man, I'm going to be really old by that time.
Yeah, I've been joking with a lot of people. Our, you know, our grandkids are really going to enjoy this transit system. That's what kind of came up yesterday, unfortunately.
So the mayor then wrote to the FTA and basically put out this information, but it was without the actual Hart didn't sign this letter, right?
Right. This is something running separate from what Hart has put out there, but it was part of a letter that the mayor put out to the FTA on Friday. And what he is trying to do with this letter is he's basically pleading that they not let lapse a $250 million portion of the city's remaining federal funding. That's what he's trying to hold on to. And in doing so, he's kind of painting this picture and saying, look, just in our rough estimates, this is what we're looking at. We think it'll be, at the latest, maybe 2033, and we're looking at a cost that really comes out to about $11 billion.
And, we have, the news that came out of council yesterday that the city might be short, several hundred million, and that's not good. So, we're going to have to figure out how we're going to pay for what they had planned on, from the city side for rail.
Right. The future is really uncertain as far as construction and, even operations. But as far as completing the project, they're certainly going to have to find more funding sources. It's not clear whether they can even go back hat in hand to the state legislature. But even if they try that, we're in the middle of a pandemic. We don't even have the money right now for basic services, right? So this could be something that's going to take a little while even to address rail and its shortfall.
Yeah, I feel like we're on the edge of another fiscal cliff. But thanks so much, Marcel.
Sure thing. Thanks, Catherine.
That was reporter Marcel Henry with today's Reality Check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for HPR comes from Alexander & Baldwin, owners and managers of office, industrial, and retail properties across the state. A&B, building partnerships in Hawaii for 150 years with a commitment to provide for the needs of island communities.
A few months ago, economist Nicholas Bloom was taking an important work call in his spare bedroom. All of a sudden, he heard this sound.
It was two of my kids starting their daily practice on the bagpipes.
This week on Hidden Brain, the challenges and opportunities of working from home.
Beginning this evening at 7, following Says You.
Are you service-minded? HPR is looking for a full-time membership coordinator to give our station members and volunteers the care and support they deserve. If you love public radio and are ready to join our lively and highly interactive workplace, learn more on the Employment Opportunities page at hawaiipublicradio.org. Applications due by November 30th.
Earlier this morning, we waded into the tide pool known as Queen's Bath on Kauai's North Shore. The pool is essentially a sinkhole surrounded by walls of magma rock, and although it's often described as beautiful, visitors to the site should be careful as injuries and deaths have occurred there from time to time. It's advised that people steer clear of Queen's Bath completely, even when the surf is flat and calm, because the waves do crash into the nearby rocks and often shoot ocean spray high into the air. So visitors should know that anyone standing in the vicinity of Queen's Bath is at risk, as the power of the waves can easily sweep a person into the ocean and out to sea. Now, Kauai isn't the only place in Hawaii to have an area referred to as Queen's Bath. The original site to carry that moniker was located on Hawaii Island in Kalapana. It formed after a lava tube collapsed and filled with fresh water supplied by natural springs. Historically, only the alii, or royalty, were permitted entry into the sacred waters. It, too, was a popular visitor destination until lava flow from Kilauea volcano destroyed the site in 1987. So Kauai's tide pool is the last Queen's Bath standing. And congratulations to Nicole from Pahoa. You got it right. We did have many callers call in to share their memories swimming in at that site at Kalapana before it was overrun by lava. And that's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Chinese historian and author Doug Chong can trace his heritage to rice farmers who lived here on Oahu. One of his books, Ancestral Reflections, Hawaii's Early Chinese and Waipahu, details the rice industry from 1885 to 1935. Chong shares a forgotten rich history of rice and its contribution to our island economy. Before corn seed and before sugar was king in Hawaii, there was the reign of rice. Chong is a driving force behind the Hawaii Chinese History Center. His passion drove him back to mainland China to fill in the gaps to the Chinese rice story here in the islands.
We have been in Hawaii for 9 generations, and the local Chinese here in Hawaii have a very unique situation because they come, 70% of the Chinese come from only one small county in China, which is Zhongshan County. And as that, we have the largest Zhongshan population in the world. I would dare say even outside of China, including China, because in China, most of the villages have been depleted of our local people who have moved off to better and, bigger things in China. But in Hawaii, they have stayed. And as such, families trace their history down to 7 to 10 generations already in Hawaii, and we all come from one area. And very little has ever been really researched and written. And so 50 years ago, the Hawaii Chinese History Center started. And we started to encourage our researchers and show them how to research to the point where we could get our writers to write about their family history, their heritage, and what it means to them to being American Chinese growing up in Hawaii and how their ancestors came to the islands. As such, we have put out almost 4 dozen books on the Chinese of Hawaii, written by the Chinese themselves. And we still carry on our heritage and our history as very few Chinese can track their original history that far back. And when they come to our history center, we can help them and show them how. Because Hawaii's Chinese population is so small due to the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Now, I was driving toward the North Shore and happened to stop at Ching's store in Punalu and was delighted to see on their wall the incredible history of rice in Punalu. And a video. The society goes back there and cleans the graves every Qingming, but not this year.
No, due to COVID, we haven't had the opportunity to do so. But Punalu was only one of the very, very many centers of rice growing. On Oahu, we had Waikiki, Makiki, Palolo, Manoa, Pearl City, Waiau, Waiava, Waipio, Waipahu, Lai, Haula, Punalu, Kahana, Waikani, Kahalu, Kailua, Kaneohe, all of them. All of this area was all in rice planting at the turn of the century. Rice planting began very early in the 1860s. The Chinese left the sugar plantations and started their stint with working with the Hawaiians, recapturing their lands. It was a very opportune time because acres of taro land lay fallow as the native population dwindled. And so the Chinese went in there, settled among the Hawaiians, restored their taro and fish ponds, taro lands and fish ponds, and took a lot of the area to drain and clear to grow their rice. Once they started their rice, more and more Chinese laborers came into the islands to help with the rice planting. They went into the areas closer to the sea, so they never affected the sugar plantations, which began much later on, about 30 years later, before the rice sugar plantations really started to take off. They took the upper lands, the drier lands, whereas we took the lower lands and the areas among the streams and the flatlands that had artesian wells.
Now, I know there is an area just off the Pali Highway as you go into Kailua, that heiau, where the community is restoring the lohi, the taro patches.
That was all in rice. That whole area was in rice. And Kailua, especially because it had the lower land, the one that always floods, and we also had all the valleys up here in the valleys. We used all the valleys up in Kailua. It was because we had so much water. We had access to water. And the valleys were very, very prized because of the water. And also, a lot of the land could be terraced, much like it is in China.
You mentioned artesian wells, and I think there's a spring over there in Mo'ili'ili.
That's right.
The popular restaurant.
There are artesian wells in Mo'ili'ili, Sheridan Street area. That whole area had artesian wells, and we had them in Waipahu area, and that made it much, much easier, because where you could not, or it was more humbug trying to separate the streams and getting the water to the rice and taro fields, the artesian wells would just bubble up and give you free access to the water.
And I'm trying to think of the name of that restaurant there.
Willows.
Willow's Restaurant, yes.
That's right. So that whole area was also in rice planting. We have many pictures of the whole Makiki Waikiki area showing Diamond Head in rice and showing Punch Bowl area in Makiki. That whole area was in rice.
Now, over in Waipahu, at the plantation village there, I understand that you've started a tradition there of actually planting rice as a part of that history?
Yes. Well, we have it just mainly for our museum. We have a very beautiful Victorian mansion there that we rebuilt there at the Waipahu Cultural Garden Park with our Chinese Society House, which is really called a Chinese temple now, and a very large original cookhouse that's still standing from 1912. And as part of our display, we show how the laborers lived there. We had, amongst the Victorian houses, we had some bungalows where these single Chinese laborers would live there. They'd work there. There was even a death house there. And for part of the display, we do cultivate rice just to show our visitors what rice looked like, because Waipahu started their rice plantations long before the sugar came in at the turn of the century. And we had that whole area, the lower area, the upper area, the side area, the Waipio area, Hawaii, Waipio, the whole area was in rice. So it was one of the largest, we had one of the largest Chinese communities next to Chinatown itself, because we had rice, we had sugar, and we grew hasu or lotus root and vegetables and poultry, and we restored all the fish ponds. So it was a thriving Chinese community there.
Now, I had the wonderful opportunity of attending a dinner that was hosted by one of the Chinese societies, and on the table was a small bag of rice paying homage to the roots of the members of that society. And I understand that group is, you know, the one that's responsible for maintaining the grave sites of those bachelor rice farmers from way back when there in Punalu.
Well, yeah, that is the Punalu Institute. We started in 1906 as a Chinese debate society, and we are still in existence today. So that is the party that you attended, and it's a very old society, and the descendants of all the Chinese who live there still operate the organization. Now, that grave site there is not only for bachelors, but it represents all the different families that lived and died among the area, because there are actually four major burial sites in the Punalu area. Collectively, we have designated just one area with two different graves as being the venerated ancestor, although there are other graves and other grave sites there in Punalu that we had. And it was actually designated quite late in history that we designated that area, because the earlier area was on the seashore where the Chinese started to bury, but then the tide started to come in, so they decided to move the area further up in the mountains. And that's the area that we have designated as our ancestral memorial.
And in doing my research, I understand that land is owned by Kamehameha Schools.
Usually, it's just the one time in April that we go up there for Qingming. But a few weeks before that, we have people help us go up there and clean the grave site area.
Well, I was really impressed, you know, in just, you know, a little afternoon jaunt up there on that side of the island to learn that history, because it's all there on the walls, and you have a wonderful little kind of a loop video that plays talking about the history of the valley.
Right. I did that many years ago, with about 2006, on the centennial of our club. And I put together this video on all the different Chinese people, the Chinese families that settled there. And it's very interesting because in Punalu, it was highly, I'd say about 95% of all the rice farmers were from only one small district of an 8-mile radius within Zhongshan County itself. And we all spoke only one dialect, which is almost totally extinct. I still speak it, but I can only speak it with the three living people who still speak that dialect. But within that, we had a microcosm, because it was just like the village area that we came from, and we all settled together. We all decided to settle together. And all of those families, as their children grew up, they used to match marry, like the Wongs would marry the Lums would marry the Chings, or the Yuans would marry the Lums, and back and forth and back and forth. But they were all one kind of people. They were all the Namlong people from the Zhongshan area. So it was a subculture in another subculture, which defines Hawaii.
And were you able to make the trek back to your village?
When I was much younger, I was very fortunate, you know, the first time I got back there, because a lot of the old people were still there, so I conducted a lot of research. And it was wonderful, because China was closed for so long. The stories that I heard as a child of 8 or 9, I used to write them down before Alex Haley even started his route. The stories of my grandmother and her sister who went to the California Gold Rush, you know, they used to sit down and tell me these stories about things happening here and in China. And long after they had died, I finally got back to China the month after Mao Zedong had passed away. And I finally got back to the village, and I found a very old man who was just sitting there in the heat and talking stories. And he wasn't too, you know, he wasn't too open to talk. So I swung into our native dialect, and he just smiled up, and he said, "You're from overseas?" I said, "Yeah, I'm, you know, I'm staying at my great-grandmother's house." And when I told him about that, he nearly cried. He said, "You know, I know them so well that I was with your granduncle when he died." And he started telling me the exact same stories that my grandmother had told me when I was a child. So, you know, it just brought this all back. And I got to sleep in my great-grandmother's house, and all her things, her pictures were on the wall, and all the dishes, things that she had brought back from Punalu were still there in the house. So we still have a very, very strong connection. Many of the books that we've written are based on what we call oral history. And oral history is far more enlightening than written history many times, because it deals with the ordinary and the everyday people and their trials, tribulations of making a life in a new country. And I think that what more than ever, what we want people to do is to realize the experiences that they went through, to be thankful, and to retain a lot of their values, their histories, the things that made them unique, that made them Chinese, because after all, it is their identity. And more, rice farming is not easy. It's not easy at all. And where we come from in Zhongshan, we did the same thing. We pushed these crops. We pushed two crops a year. And to push two major crops a year, that was hard work, because it's not only clearing the land and then planting the seeds and then harvesting, and fertilizing and chasing the rice birds with the musket and tin cans, and then harvesting with the sickles and cutting your hand with them. And it was hard work. And even ladies like my great-grandmother and my grandmother with bound feet would go out and help them. And they'd winnow the rice and everything until they had the rice mills really going. It was a lot. It was labor-intensive. And that's the very reason why we lost it in the late 1920s. By then, the Chinese laborers were nearly all dead or retired. They were too old to work the field. Mm. And because of the exclusion law, we could not bring in any more Chinese who'd continue. Also, pestilence had, the pests and the weevils had gotten into the rice crops, and it was no longer profitable. So that whole thing died out about that area. By the 1920s, by 1930, there was nothing left. And the Japanese took over the few areas in Kauai and the valleys to grow the mochi rice. But there was no more rice after that.
That was Douglas Chong, author and Chinese historian, talking about the reign of rice here on Oahu. He's president of the Hawaii Chinese History Center, which is located on North King Street. It's open to the public, but has limited appointment hours from 10 to noon on Wednesdays. Well, that's it for today. Up tomorrow, we finish off our week-long look at rice, visiting a shop in Kaka'ako that mills rice. You can call our talkback line or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.